This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll talk with the new leader of the Illinois Senate Republicans, Dan McConkie. There's some good news about teen drivers. Are they better prepared thanks to a more than decade-old state law? We'll have a conversation about that. Keeping kids motivated during remote learning is not easy. It's also difficult for teachers. We'll hear from one of them. Battling addiction is difficult at any time, let alone during a pandemic. We'll find out why some say treatment has helped prepare them. And a young woman who died from COVID-19. Her family shares her story.
It's not your typical death experience where the family gets to surround you and you get to say your goodbyes and you're holding their hand as they pass. COVID has taken that all away.
That and more ahead on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll hear how some with addiction problems are handling the pandemic. We'll also talk with the new Republican leader in the Illinois Senate about what he sees ahead. And can athletes compete wearing masks? The Illinois High School Association is requiring them for basketball players. We'll learn about some research being done regarding masks and high-intensity exercise. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Names and faces get lost in the din of COVID-19 statistics, and it's easy to become numb to it. But the family of McLean County's youngest coronavirus victim wants to make sure that doesn't happen. Dana Vollmer brings us their story.
30-year-old Danielle Cater of Bloomington died Tuesday. The McLean County Health Department reported her death as a woman in her 30s who did not have any prior health conditions and was not affiliated with a long-term care facility. But Danny's family offers a more robust account of her life. Cater was an only child. Her father, Bob Rubin, recalls her always being kind, studious, and passionate about animals.
And she was just a very caring person. And she frequently would put others first.
Danny graduated from Mount Zion High School in 2008 and went on to study accountancy at North Central College in Naperville. She later brought her financial savvy to a career at Kepler Vision. Tina Rubin says what bonded her and her daughter together was their insatiable love of reading.
I mean, as a child, that was a 2 or 3 day in a row trip to the library with, 10, 15 books coming home with us at a time, whatever the maximum that was allowed.
When her nose wasn't in a book, Danny could be found at the horse barn. She loved riding, performing in shows, and helping others foster their passion for the sport. Danny met her husband, Tim Cater, when they were young teens. Cater said Danny's loving, caring, and genuine personality sealed the deal. They grew up, went off to college, and managed long distance until graduation. Then came the marriage, the dog, and the house.
It's just your classic high school sweetheart love story. It's really like we just wrote a napkin sketch of what the rest of our lives was going to be. And that's the way it played out up until now.
Cater says his wife's COVID illness was unexpected and fast moving. The first sign that she had contracted COVID-19 was a loss of taste and smell that started a week before she passed away. She got tested the next day and it came back positive 3 days later. Over the weekend, she was showing more symptoms. Breathing became a little bit harder. Come Sunday, Cater says they were starting to feel a little uneasy. They called a doctor who sent them off with some prescriptions. Still, no real red flags were raised.
Monday morning, we bought an oximeter. It clips onto your finger and tells you your oxygen levels in your blood. And they're supposed to be about 95 typically, and hers were 60. And that's the moment it hits you, that this is bad.
They called an ambulance. Cater followed his wife to Carl Broman in Bloomington. Danny was admitted to intensive care while Tim had to leave her at the door. Cater says they put Danny on a mask to help her breathe, which she initially responded well to, but things started going downhill fast that evening. Doctors put her on a ventilator, but that didn't seem to be working either.
They tried everything they could think of. She put up a really, really good fight, but she passed away that Tuesday morning.
That was less than 24 hours after Danny was admitted to the ICU. Losing your loved one at 30 is unfathomable under any circumstances. Tina Rubin says the hardest part of her daughter's death is the loneliness of it.
It's not your typical death experience where the family gets to surround you and you get to say your goodbyes and you're holding their hand as they pass. COVID has taken that all away.
Ruben says what's helping get them through is becoming her daughter's advocate to help others take COVID-19 seriously.
Hopefully helping educate people that, you know, this is real. You know, it should have never become a political issue.
She says now is a time people need to pull together and do the right thing. I'm Dana Vollmer.
The COVID-19 pandemic is fueling another public health crisis involving addiction. The added stress and uncertainty can make people in recovery more vulnerable to relapse. But as Christine Herman reports, some say treatment prepared them for what was to come.
Barbara Allen is 39. She lives in Springfield, Illinois, where she works with people who have disabilities and live in group homes. She's also a mom who's trying to give her children a better life than she had. Barb grew up poor, experiencing homelessness several times as a little girl. And her mom had an illness that sent her to a nursing home, leaving Barb, who was only 12 at the time, to fend for herself.
I really didn't have any relatives. I just had my friend that I went to school with. Her mom was a nurse. She took me in.
But when she was 16, Barb started drinking and says she was put out for not following the rules. She dropped out of school and was living on her own. And then her mom died.
She suffered her whole life. So when she died, it really wasn't a bad thing. I felt like she was at peace. I think I just missed her.
Barb didn't realize it at the time, but she struggled with anxiety and was using alcohol to cope.
I didn't know what was wrong. I just thought it was normal. I thought what I was going through was normal, but it was so far from normal.
In 2018, Barb was raped by someone she knew, and she says it pushed her over the edge.
Basically, almost ruined my life. I caught a DUI. You know, when I didn't drink, I used to have the shakes real bad. So at that point, I realized I needed to go into recovery because if I didn't, I was going to ruin my life.
Last year, she began outpatient treatment for alcoholism, 5 days a week on top of her full-time job.
The first week, I thought about relapsing every day. I would go to the liquor store, buy something, but then I would throw it out the window as I thought about drinking it.
She stuck with it. She started seeing a therapist and taking medications to treat her anxiety and prevent a relapse. By the time the COVID-19 pandemic hit, Barb had been sober for more than a year, and the new mindset she gained through treatment, being honest about her struggles and letting go of what she can't control, kept her from spiraling back into addiction.
I was prepared for anything. I felt like if I overcame being raped, overcame addiction, overcame losing my parents, that I was ready to face this pandemic head on.
Mercedes Kent is a clinical supervisor at Gateway Foundation, where Barb got help. She says Barb was fortunate to have learned coping skills and built a supportive community before the pandemic disrupted everything. Kent says for many in rehab and others who may have been casual drug users, the sudden lack of social connection was enough to tip them over the edge.
It was kind of just the perfect storm. You know, the pandemic is definitely, it's a national relapse trigger.
We're going to be seeing the negative effects of this probably for years. It's a disaster from all aspects.
Dr. Paul Early is president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. He says if there is a silver lining for this pandemic, it's that providers have been forced to ramp up telehealth offerings. That can never replace face-to-face interaction, but can increase access.
There's a real shortage of quality addiction providers and quality physicians who prescribe medications for addiction, and telehealth helps extend the reach of the people we do have.
Research shows alcohol consumption in the U.S. is up 14% during the pandemic compared to last year. Early suspects this will correlate with a rise in alcohol use disorders. But he hopes people understand that getting help during the pandemic is doable. It just might require more effort. Barb says she hid her addiction from others because she was ashamed. But taking the first step to get help was the best decision for herself and her children.
Before I could take care of them, I had to fix me. I had to heal me. That was the biggest thing I could ever do for myself.
Barb says her life is still stressful, but thanks to medication and social support, she feels equipped to handle whatever comes her way. I'm Christine Herman.
there will be a new member of the Illinois Supreme Court starting next month. Justice Robert Carter is set to be sworn in, replacing Thomas Kilbride. Kilbride failed to win retention in the recent election, the first time that's happened to a Supreme Court justice in Illinois in more than 50 years. Carter, like Kilbride, is a Democrat, and the seat is one that Republicans have targeted to gain a majority on the court for the first time since the 1960s. Carter was appointed on a unanimous vote of the Supreme Court justices. His term will last until 2022. That's when voters will weigh in again. He has indicated he will not seek a full term. He's 74 years old and from Ottawa. Carter became a judge in 1979 and most recently served on the 3rd District Appellate Court. The number of deaths associated with teen driving accidents has fallen by nearly 75% in the past dozen years. Henry Haupt is a spokesman for Secretary of State Jesse White, and I talked with him about the numbers. He credits a graduated driver's licensing law, approved in 2008, for helping to reduce teen driving deaths.
The graduated driver licensing program began working immediately. Once Secretary White got all the components passed into law and it took effect in 2008, we immediately saw a 40% decrease in teen driving deaths. And it's continued to decrease basically year after year. And we're at our lowest number in 2019, according to the Illinois Department of Transportation, where 41 teens were killed in traffic crashes. That's a significant decrease from the 155 that died in 2007, the last year before Secretary White implemented the graduated driver licensing law and strengthened the law throughout the state. And the graduated driver licensing program works because it better prepares young drivers to drive safely, and it does so in a manner where they gradually obtain new freedoms at driving. One of the key changes is it tripled the permit phase from 3 months to 9 months and requires 50 practice hours with a parent or guardian beside the teen. And what this does is it gives the teen an opportunity to drive in various weather conditions common to Illinois throughout that nine-month period. It's very important to identify potentially bad drivers immediately. So if a teenager with their permit is convicted of a moving violation, their nine-month permit phase starts over. Once they've successfully navigated the 9 months without any traffic convictions and they obtain their driver's license, for the first year, they're limited to only one teen driver in the car with them, because studies show that novice teen drivers fall victim to in-car distractions. And what Illinois' law does is it limits those.
Henry, there are also, I know, other rules in place there, such as limits on when a young person can be driving, a curfew, basically, and late at night, keeping them off the road at times where that's proven to be sort of an unsafe period, correct?
Yes, that's right. The permit phase and throughout their driving, actually, they have curfews of either 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock, whether it's weekdays or weekends. And this is for anyone under the age of 18.
It's really an approach, I guess, sort of a carrot and a stick type thing, where if you want your license, you pay attention, you don't break the law, and there's a reward system for young drivers. That's really what it's modeled on, correct?
Absolutely, it is. It's modeled on an approach that rewards good driving behavior. And Illinois' GDL program is extremely comprehensive in that it takes each of the components that experts have recommended it and wraps it into one program. And the program is more powerful than the individual components. Put together, it works very well. And it was designed all along to save lives and to reduce teen driving deaths. And we're very pleased that it's been successful over the last 13 years in doing so and continues to be successful.
You know, I can look back to when I first started driving, and of course, long before this law took effect. And I guess I was a typical teenager, distracted at times, not always following the rules of the road as I should have. The goal, as you mentioned, was to develop these better habits as drivers. It seems like something, when I look back on it, I'm sure many other people my age would look back and think, I probably would have benefited from this additional time and some of these additional restrictions that are put in place. And that was one of the reasons why this seemed to be so popular, not just here in Illinois, but across the country.
Yeah, and it's important to emphasize that Secretary White, he got, frankly, sick and tired of reading in newspapers and watching and news stories about the number of teens that were being killed throughout the state going back to 2007 and before that. And he had just had enough of that and, as a result, committed himself to creating this task force back in 06 and 07 that put together really the most cutting-edge components of a graduated driver licensing program. The General Assembly passed it into law. And like I said, right away that first year we had the new GDL program, we saw teen driving deaths drop 40%. It's really rewarding to think we played a role in creating a new driving program for teens that has helped ensure many more people that were teenagers then, they're older now, are alive and well. One of the things we heard from parents, actually, is they really like the 9-month permit phase. They like the idea that they got to spend 50 hours with their 15-year-old behind the wheel. But they said they're not a driver's ed instructor, so they didn't really know what to look for. So we worked with the PTA and the driver's education community, and we put together a parent teen driver's guide, and it's on the website, www.cyberdriveillinois.com, where parents can download that guide, and it gives them kind of a step-by-step tutorial of what to look for when their teen just starts driving and how they can gradually implement more complicated driving maneuvers in a safe way. And parents have really appreciated that, and it's something that has helped them better prepare their teens, because all the experts will say parental involvement is a key component in a successful graduated driver licensing program, and Illinois parents have really stepped up.
That's Henry Haupt, a spokesman for Illinois Secretary of State Jesse White. Teen driver accident fatalities are down nearly 75% since the graduated driver's licensing law was put into place in 2008. Well, just ahead, research on mask wearing during activities like basketball. Stay with us on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Farm equipment, it's designed to be used by men. Why that's a problem with more women doing that type of work, we'll have a report coming up. The Illinois High School Association plans to require basketball players to wear masks on the court if they're going to play this season. Most schools still have not decided whether or not they'll play. Illinois State University exercise science professor Kristen Legale tells Eric Stock that science doesn't yet have a clear picture on how manageable mask wearing is during high-intensity exercise.
I think my first thought with masks during exercise was that was going to be uncomfortable for a lot of people, and it might reduce the amount of physical activity that actually got done, which is, you know, not as the opposite direction that we want to go. We want people to be more physically active. So I think my first thought was concern that it would prevent people from being physically active.
Do you think that's been the case, or have we learned to adjust, or maybe in some cases they're just deciding not to bother with it?
I think the mask issue itself has not been a problem because we've been allowed to be physically active without the mask. Right? So the state guidelines are you need to wear a mask when you're not exercising, but when you are exercising, as long as you're socially distanced, you don't have to wear the mask. So the mask issue itself, I don't think has been preventative for physical activity. I think COVID maybe has.
And some of the data that you had shared suggests that masks, when used during resistance exercise, mm-hmm. such as lifting weights, strength training, leads to reduced performance and higher perceived exertion, but seem to have less effect for aerobic exercise.
Right.
Would you expect the opposite to be true there?
I was a little surprised by that. I think the aerobic exercise piece just really hasn't been looked at for whatever reason. But yes, I would imagine that given the need for oxygen consumption during aerobic exercise, that perhaps mask would be more limiting during aerobic exercise than it would during resistance exercise.
Well, coaches resisted the idea at first about their athletes wearing masks, the ones that we've heard from, but several we've talked to since have said maybe they can do it. The players are getting used to it. The Illinois High School Association has added additional timeouts during games to help with the cardio response. Perhaps they accept it because they have no other option. If they want to play, they have to do it. But how easy of an adjustment do you think that would be for an athlete to have to wear a mask during their activity?
I personally don't think it would be an easy adjustment. But again, this is opinion. I think my personal experience is that it is uncomfortable to wear a mask, especially once the intensity of the exercise gets high. So I think it would depend upon what they're doing. You know, in a game situation, I think it could be super challenging in a variety of ways. It could be uncomfortable. It could increase the perceived exertion of the activity. I think it might be challenging to keep them on their faces. So, you know, what happens when you're in the middle of a intense play and the mask falls off? I don't know if that's been addressed or if there's concerns about that, but I could see it being challenging.
What advice would you have for parents who are not sure if their son or daughter playing basketball is a wise choice for them? What should they be thinking about as they make that decision?
I would tell your child that if it's uncomfortable, if they start to feel uncomfortable, to reduce their exercise intensity. So that's one thing I think might have to happen, is that the intensity of the activity might need to be lowered when wearing a mask for whatever reason. If it's perceived exertion, discomfort, whatever, I think we have to be prepared to decrease exercise intensity.
Would that be a message for the coaches? Because you're playing in an ultra-competitive environment.
Right.
They're not going to willingly dial right. back themselves.
Right. Yes, I think potentially that's something to consider, because we don't want the players to feel discomfort, period, right? I think in any situation, if a player was feeling uncomfortable, I would hope that a coach would make sure that the intensity of the exercise or the exercise itself was stopped, right? You want to deal with its discomfort. So if that's an issue, then yes, coaches are going to need to be aware that they may have to stop or at least bring down the intensity of the activity. I think that's a distinct possibility.
That's Illinois State University exercise science professor Kristen Legale talking with Eric Stock. Legale suggests that athletes bring extra masks with them because sweat makes them less effective. And she says neck gaiters are not a good alternative because they can be difficult to keep in place during exercise. And the IHSA's executive director, Craig Anderson, also says that the board of the association wants to build a more collaborative relationship with the state and other education groups when it meets on November 19th. That's 3 days after basketball practices are set to begin. The IHSA also says it has invited representatives, including those from the Illinois Association of School Administrators, the State Board of Education, and the Illinois Principals Association, to participate in the meeting, along with a group of nearly 200 school superintendents who recently contacted the governor's office regarding school sports. Men have long dominated the farming world, so not surprisingly, farm equipment, things like tractors, tillers, or hand tools, are designed to be used by males. Female-friendly tools are hard to come by, and as Dana Cronin reports, with more women farming every year, that presents a safety issue.
Dusty Spurgeon has a love-hate relationship with her tractor. She helps run Spurgeon Veggies, a small vegetable farm in Ryo, Illinois, along with her mother-in-law. As a woman-owned and operated business, one of the biggest hurdles they face is the equipment they farm with. Starting with the tractor. Tractors are often used to pull different implements for plowing, for planting, or for harvesting. Switching those out is not easy. You often need a lot of upper body strength.
You are pushing this thing forward to fit it onto that part, and then you have to get it all the way on, which is really freaking hard.
Frustrating. Spurgeon uses that word over and over again.
I hate it. It makes me feel incompetent. I can't do my job.
It's not just changing the implements on the tractor. It's everything about the way the tractor is designed. She finds the parking brake almost impossible to engage. The fuel tank is located at the top of the tractor, meaning she has to lift a heavy fuel can up above her head to gas up. The tractor also has a safety bar that needs to be up in case it flips. It's a very heavy bar.
Oh. Oh my God.
Spurgeon says she's lucky that she's taller and stronger than the average woman.
If you were a 5'1" woman trying to like put the roll bar thing up or change out the PTO or whatever, I don't know that it would be possible to do without like the pretty major potential for injury.
Many of these features are hard for everyone to use. Spurgeon is the first to admit that. But women are at a particular disadvantage, says Josie Rudolphi, who researches agricultural safety and health at the University of Illinois.
These were designed for people of a certain weight and certain height, pretty much reflective of the male population in the United States.
She says farming is already a dangerous job, and for women, the potential for injury is high. So some are stepping in to help. Ann Adams and Liz Brensinger own Green Heron Tools, which has trademarked the term hergonomic. Their tools, designed for women, are generally lighter, have patented grips to accommodate smaller hands, and come in a variety of sizes. Adams and Brensinger are farmers themselves and got frustrated with the lack of female-friendly tools on the market.
I mean, there were companies that painted crappy tools pink and called them ladies' tools, but we couldn't find a single case of tools or equipment in the ag sector that had been scientifically designed to work well for women.
Brensinger says women have always played an important role on the farm, and that role only continues to grow. According to the most recent USDA Ag Census data, about 36% of all farmers are female, and that number has been steadily increasing for the past decade.
To have women playing this important role and having to use tools and equipment that don't fit them, that, you know, aren't going to work as well for them as they need something to, and that might actually hurt them, there's just something really wrong with that picture.
She says this is a public health and safety issue, and until female-friendly tools are more widely available, farmers like Dusty Spurgeon will continue to put their bodies at risk to accomplish everyday farm tasks. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
The coronavirus pandemic is just the latest in a string of newly discovered highly infectious diseases. Many of them start in animals and can have just as big of an impact on our lives, even if they don't jump to humans. Brian Grimmett reports on how the ag industry is using lessons learned from COVID-19 to prepare.
Emerging infectious diseases, like the coronavirus, don't just threaten humans. They're also a major threat to the chickens, pigs, and cattle that become food for billions of people. If a foreign animal disease, such as foot and mouth, African swine fever, or one we've not even discovered yet, made it to the U.S., it would cost the U.S. economy billions, if not trillions, of dollars.
We have a lot of movement of animals. We have very integrated systems. And disease could spread very easily.
That's Jack Scher. He's the Associate Administrator for Emergency Program Planning, Response, and Security at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He says there's a lot his agency can learn from the U.S. response to the coronavirus, mainly that an emergency response to an infectious disease requires a lot of equipment and scientists to be in place before it happens.
No one likes to pay for all the response capabilities when nothing happens. But then when it happens, people look at each other and say, why weren't we better prepared?
But the coronavirus isn't the first wake-up call for the agency. In 2015, a highly infectious strain of avian influenza wreaked havoc on the chicken and turkey industry in the upper Midwest. In total, more than 50 million birds died from or had to be euthanized because of the disease. It also resulted in trade restrictions that caused more than $1 billion in lost export revenue.
They are devastating diseases. That's why we want to keep them out. And that's our goal.
A big part of that strategy involves the Department of Homeland Security, which supports several important research laboratories such as Plum Island Animal Disease Center in New York State. Bob Burns leads one of Homeland Security's science and technology divisions. He says people shouldn't be surprised if a foreign animal disease shows up. In fact, they should be surprised more haven't already.
It's always a threat. It's the potential for emergent threats, emergent diseases, future diseases is real. And we need to pay attention to that.
He says, just as we've seen with the coronavirus outbreak, a key to stopping a foreign animal disease will be quickly identifying what it is and where it's been. But you can't have a diagnostic test ready if you're not already studying or aware of the disease. That's why DHS is currently constructing a $1.2 billion facility in Manhattan, Kansas, known as the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. When up and running in 2022, it will be one of only four labs in the world that can work with large, live animals and highly infectious, deadly diseases for which there aren't vaccines. As hard as the USDA and Homeland Security work to prevent a disease from reaching the United States, the first to recognize an actual outbreak will likely be the farmers, ranchers, and feedlot operators that are in constant contact with thousands of animals every day. Brandon Deppenbush is the vice president of cattle operations for Innovative Livestock Services. It operates 8 feedlots in Kansas and Nebraska. At his feedlot in Great Bend, Kansas, he says caregivers perform a health check on every pen at least once a day.
So I mean, one caregiver gets in each pen, and we'll go around and make sure we get every animal up, walk them around, and look at them visually and make sure that they don't have any signs or symptoms of any kind of disease. And look for same thing we look for in our kids, runny nose, you know, a depressed look and that type of stuff.
Deppenbush says he thinks about the consequences of a foreign animal disease outbreak almost every day. It's why he's participating in the Secure Beef Supply Program. It's a coordinated effort between the USDA and a few states, including Colorado and Kansas, to help train and prepare cattle, pork, and poultry operations on disease response plans.
Yes, it's a plan sitting on the shelf. We want to make sure that it stays on the shelf, but at the same time, when it times to do, they can open the book and say, yeah, I know what I'm going to do.
That's Kansas Animal Health Commissioner Justin Smith. He says in the case of an outbreak, the department's plan is aggressive. That means immediately stopping all movement of animals, tracing where infected animals have been, and setting up barriers between operations to prevent disease from spreading. And that last one is a real challenge. Deppenbush says at any one of his feed yards, they'll have as many as 75 delivery trucks enter the property every day, each one potentially carrying a disease from another lot.
Yeah, at the entry gate, we would have a checkpoint, and depending on the scenario, it would be a wash, a cleaning, and a disinfectant. So we would wash the wheels, the wheel carriage, undercarriage of any debris, and then disinfectant.
That'll slow down the feedlots and require a lot more workers. He says that's not sustainable long-term, but it's a lot cheaper than the alternative, which is getting a call from the State Department of Agriculture telling you to euthanize 30,000 head of cattle.
That might be one of the things that's come out of COVID-19 is maybe now producers are saying, you know what, maybe I ought to give that a little bit more thought on our operation and what would happen if we have that.
Deppenbush is also involved in an effort to create an automated cattle tracking system known as U.S. Cattle Trace, which Kansas piloted. But he says some producers are worried about government intrusion into their data, which is only shared during the emergency.
Cannot talk about enhanced biosecurity plans without at least mentioning animal identification, because one without the other is not good.
Plus, in 2008, Kansas started doing large-scale foreign animal disease disaster drills, multi-day exercises involving producers and several state agencies. Scarlett Hagens is the vice president of communications for the Kansas Livestock Association. She says the drills have been a huge success. They've also helped strengthen relationships between producers and the state, which will be necessary if serious measures need to be taken to stop a disease. If you're looking for a parallel, think about the debate over the mask mandate.
I think the trust is there, and that if something came up and this is kind of, you know, this is what would need to be done, I think that our producers would do the best they could to accommodate that.
Kansas is unique. It's the only state currently doing drills on this scale and frequency. Smith, the Kansas Animal Health Commissioner, says it's not that the ag departments in other states aren't aware or concerned. It's that lawmakers and governors haven't made it a priority yet. And that worries him.
There's really not a whole lot sovereign about those state lines. I mean, they're pretty porous, and we have a lot of movement that happens across state line, and we have a lot of businesses that happen across the state line.
The plan to respond to the next foreign animal disease outbreak shares a lot in common with the recommended response to COVID-19. To stop either, you have to have systems in place to test and trace. You have to isolate the infected from the healthy, and in the end, the heaviest burden falls to state and local agencies, most of which aren't nearly as prepared as they should be. I'm Brian Grimmett.
Each week, Statewide brings you reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. We're glad you're with us this week. And still to come, teachers trying to stay motivated during remote learning. That's up next. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll speak with the next leader of the Illinois Senate Republicans. That's just ahead. But first, since remote learning began, some teachers say sitting for long hours in front of a computer is not just hard on students, but also on them. Adriana Cardona-Magiga is following a special education teacher in Chicago who's trying to stay motivated even in the most uncertain of times.
I've been following Jessica Vega since school started last month. We've talked on the phone and in person several times. She lives with her parents and siblings on the southwest side. Her teaching space is in the basement, which she shares with her brother.
I mean, this is my desk. This is it. I don't use this whiteboard because kids can't really see it if I have my computer over here.
Her basement setup is simple. She uses a tissue box as a makeshift laptop stand, and a shower curtain separates her space from her brother's workout equipment and home office.
My brother started working from home too, and so he has his desk on the other half, and I have mine over here.
She's 24 years old and a third-year teacher at Piccolo Elementary on the northwest side. She works with 8 students who have some type of learning disability, including challenges recognizing sounds in reading and understanding patterns in math. They're all 8th graders, and each day, most of them are expected to spend nearly 4 hours in real-time online instruction and more than 2 hours of learning activities that Vega plans. The remote learning schedule this fall is more rigid than in the spring when schools first shut down. Since the very first day of school, the new routine has been taking a toll on Vega.
It's making me extremely exhausted. When the kids say they're really tired, like, I understand their fatigue. It's just being in front of a screen for so many hours is exhausting. We need more than just 5-minute breaks sometimes.
For the last 7 weeks, Vega feels like she's repeating her first year teaching all over again.
So when I started teaching, this is definitely not what I imagined I would end up doing in my third year. As many teachers know, like, the first year is probably one of the most difficult and stressful years. And I feel like that again because I'm learning everything again.
She's a teacher, social worker, and tech guru all rolled into one. She has to support her students, coordinate with other teachers to modify the curriculum for them. And after she spends hours planning her lessons, many times students have technical difficulties or don't turn their cameras on. This month, she says, has been the hardest.
October this year has been frustrating in the sense that we've been doing it for like a month, and it still feels like we've never done this before sometimes, which is really frustrating. I think that's just it. It's coping with the frustration as like, what am I doing? Am I not doing enough?
She holds on to the moments when it's clear her students are learning.
And so sometimes, I think this happened yesterday where one of my students got the answer. I was like, yes, like I did, I twirled in my chair and I was like, yes. And then they put like an LOL, okay, and like that was okay, I'll take that, like, great.
Now she's finding ways to cope with the stress and frustration. Simple things like taking her dog on a walk helps. Vega joined 2 book clubs, and she's also forcing herself to not work on the weekends or in the afternoons after school hours.
If I think of what I did on the weekend, which is sometimes something so simple as I cleaned my place, it feels so nice to just do that. Spending time with my family over the weekend, I went camping.
The school district is talking about returning to in-person learning, and she has a lot of questions and concerns. Vega says she and other teachers have invested so much in trying to make remote learning work that they don't want to throw that away. They want to make it better. But the big question remains, can they do it? And if they can, at what cost to their students and to themselves? Adriana Cardona-Magigad, WBEC News.
Illinois Republicans have been a shrinking minority, at least in state government. After a disappointing showing in the recent election, Republican members of the state Senate said they will support a change in leadership, from Bloomington's Bill Brady to Dan McConkie, a GOP senator from Chicago's northwest suburbs. McConkie will formally become the Senate minority leader in January. He spoke with R. Hannah Meisel about what he sees as the soul of the Illinois Republican Party. McConkie laid out his goals for his caucus and the state GOP more broadly as parties begin thinking about the next election.
So why run for Senate Republican leader? What were you frustrated by? And, you know, when did these conversations start internally?
Well, you know, we're always talking about ways in which we can grow and make our caucus better. There has been a longstanding desire and frustration, if you will, within the caucus of the number of seats that we've lost over the past few years. And in, you know, in this election cycle, you know, the Senate lost a seat while the House gained two seats, and there was such an overwhelming vote against the progressive tax and you know, in favor of change on the state Supreme Court. And so, given that environment, there were a number of people in the caucus who are just like, look, you know, we need to try to pursue voters. We need to make sure that we're framing what we're the value proposition that we're asking people to vote on at the ballot box in a manner that is what the voters are actually asking for, rather than, you know, maybe what it is that we think they're wanting to hear from us, right? We need to be much more reflective, much more, listen a lot more to what it is that they're saying, and then craft policies in a manner that will get them to vote for us. And at the end of the day, look, I mean, this is a state that, you know, went wide for Hillary Clinton, was called within the first minute of polls closing for Joe Biden, you know, and yet we have a great deal of dysfunction at the state level under Democrat management. And that's why it's really important for us to then put forward a value proposition that will attract those voters who may be voting blue up top, but I help them understand if they want real change in the manner of which they showed us with the grad tax, they need to vote Republican at the state level.
What challenges does your caucus face when you think about how to present yourselves politically? Like, and how do those mirror or contrast with the challenges faced by the Illinois Republican Party at large? Is it that the party can't seem to decide where it is on Trumpism? Is it that the party for the last decade has relied on this message of Mike Madigan is corrupt? You know, obviously you have ideas, but those ideas are just overshadowed by this very loud banging the drum on Madigan.
Well, certainly you can't win elections just by being against something. I mean, that if you want to go back and look at history, what we saw in 1994 when Republicans took over the U.S. House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years was that they didn't just run against Bill Clinton at the time. They had concrete proposals. In that case, they put it in with the Contract with America. But you know, they came up with concrete proposals that were differentiated them from Democrats in a manner that a wide swath of voters embraced. And so they did that in a manner that were showing what they were for. Yeah, were they against what Bill Clinton had done in regards to healthcare and, you know, other things along that line? Sure. I mean, they did that. And obviously you have to draw a contrast with your opponents. I mean, In the race in my area for state representative on the eastern half of my district, it was Chris Boss versus Mary Edley Allen. And in that case, you know, it appears we'll see at 5 o'clock today when they dump the last of the votes in, it appears that Chris Boss won by a decent margin. You know, in the messaging in that race was, yeah, there was stuff about Mike Madigan, but here was the other things that Chris was for. And I think actually the grad tax proposal being on the ballot helped him differentiate, because his opponent in that case had voted for that. So he was talking about alternatives, but things that he was for in that regard. And so you can't just be, you know, we're against Mike Madigan. You have to have concrete policies that people are going to choose instead. Otherwise, they're just going to choose, you know, the devil that they know, if you will.
And what about, I mean, President Trump will be gone come January, but, you know, the shadow of the politics that he created and fostered over the last 5 years will likely remain. So where does and should the caucus and largely the Illinois Republican Party fall on that?
One of the things that we've seen over the past few years is an increasing tendency of people to vote uniformly on their ticket. They're either going to go and vote Democrat straight down their ticket or vote Republican. The number of what we call split ticket voters has shrunk. It has shrunk over the past 20 years, but is particularly shrunk, I think, with the nationalization of politics. And what I think is important, what is really important for the Republican Party to do here is to relocalize our politics, right? It's to differentiate ourselves in a manner from whatever's happening at the federal level. I mean, look, we're running for state level offices, and our success or failure should not be tied. I mean, if we are simply waiting around for the next Ronald Reagan to come along who has coattails long enough to pull us across the finish line, we're not doing our job, right? We're not doing our job in saying our message and in communicating to the people what it is that they want to hear. I think that the more that we get into a debate and discussion and run campaigns based on policy and not on, you know, kind of ideological, you know, frames or the type of you know, characterizations that has gone on over the past few years at the national level. If we return to those concepts of ideas and policies, I think Republicans have a bright future here in Illinois, because there's so many factors over our current situation. I mean, our dire financial situation. We have a massive problem, our huge unfunded pension liability, and so forth. We're able to talk about kind of those issues. And when we talk about them with people, I mean, look, the grad tax vote was a great example of that. When you take an issue and put it on the ballot, people vote overwhelmingly conservative or overwhelmingly, you know, against the ideas that Democrats here in Illinois have been pursuing. We need to return to that frame of ideas.
I want to talk about campaign fundraising for a minute, because, you know, in the Rauner years, you had Bruce Rauner, who was himself basically self-funded, but then he brought along his wealthy pals, Ken Griffin and Dick Ulin, and it was kind of a question mark for a while there whether Griffin and Ulin would engage in this cycle, but then they ended up coming through. But do you think that the, you know, Republican Party and then your caucus should be reliant on that kind of sort of deus ex machina of a billionaire coming through?
No. I mean, look, what it is that's fundamentally necessary is being able to paint a picture of hope for people who are donating. You know, that is what I can't tell you how many people that I've gone out and talked to, and they're like, yeah, you know, we're not giving right now. We don't see. We want to know what a plan is. We want to know where you're going. You know, there's a lot of people in the state. Look, Illinois is a wealthy state by comparison to many states. We have many people very successful here. A lot of that is due to, you know, the Chicago and the number of companies, Fortune 500 companies and so forth that are here. We have some very successful people here, very successfully minded in that, you know, they're investor types. And what they're interested in is hearing, where is it that you're going to go as a caucus, as a party? They want to know what the plan is and how you're going to get there before they're going to step up and invest. And that's what I think that we need to do, you know, as soon as possible, is to put that together, go out and begin to show them those things, show them what the plan is. Because look, here in 2 years, 2 years is a really big year. We're going to have redistricting coming up in this next spring, which is going to change the map, right? So it's a really big year. And what's going to be necessary for us to compete is to go out and raise money up and down the scale, right? We're going to need to go to wealthy people. We're going to need to go to regular folks and have them, you know, put in their $25 or their $50 to do that. It's going to require all hands on deck, especially after the grad tax vote. We have data now that once the vote is certified on a per precinct basis, we're going to be able to see areas in which people were wholeheartedly against the grad tax, but still voted Democratic. And our goal needs to be to get into those areas and link the Republican brand with why people voted no. And in doing that, that's going to give us a great opportunity to gain seats in 2022 and provide a good platform, a good base for whoever is going to be our candidate for governor to have a good shot at being able to win the governorship.
That's State Senator Dan McConkie, soon to be the Illinois Senate Republican leader. He spoke with Hannah Meisel. You can hear more of that conversation at statewideshow.com. That's all the time we have for Statewide, but we'll be back next week and have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you want to find out more about this week's program or past shows, also available at our website, statewideshow.com. And like us on Facebook, you can stay connected with us. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.